Welcome to Our Interesting Times with host Timothy Kelly, who interviews today's top alternative and revisionist thinkers.
May you live in interesting times.
My guest tonight is Dean Arnold. Dean, how are you doing?
Doing great.
Dean comes back again to discuss, well, last time we talked about his book, Hillary and Vince. Tonight, Hillary and Vince, a love story, death. Hillary and Vince, a story of love, death, and cover-up. Dean is a journalist and a publisher in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and is the author of Old Money, New South, which is kind of what we're talking about tonight. We're talking about local elites and how that might give us some sort of insight into how the global elite operate. Dean, you gave a talk, at least you posted a talk, I'm not sure when you gave it, about local power structures and global power structures.
Correct.
And so let's get into that. So how do you want to take on that topic, start into it?
Well, let me just take a couple minutes here and just talk about Chattanooga and the local power structure here and tell you a few stories, and then you can kind of take it from there. Chattanooga, Tennessee, metropolitan statistical area of about 500,000 in southeastern Tennessee, it's a big Civil War city. It's second largest Civil War city, second largest battle in the Civil War behind Gettysburg. And it was just a small town, a town of 2,000. But after the huge war, all these rich generals from well-heeled families came through here. And they had a battle, such a large battle here, because of the railroads. Lincoln really wanted Chattanooga taken because it was such a strategic crossway through the mountains and all this kind of stuff. And so these generals saw the strategic area for railroads, and they also saw all the coal and iron ore and stuff in the mountains. And several of them came back and started manufacturing centers here. And so the town started to explode. And so there was captains of industry and manufacturing, that those kind of fortunes emerged in the late 1800s. But the real emergence of a very, very moneyed elite power structure in Chattanooga began to develop big time starting in 1899 with Coca-Cola bottling starting in Chattanooga. Coca-Cola started in Atlanta. Most people are familiar with that story, the romantic notion of Coca-Cola, and it was a fountain drink. It wasn't in bottles. And the guy who owned it, Asa Candler, wasn't interested in putting in bottles. He didn't think there was much money in that. And a couple attorneys from Chattanooga came down and begged him for the rights to bottle it. And he said, okay, fine. He said, as long as you just buy the syrup for me, do whatever you want. And so, 20 years later, the people in Chattanooga were making far more money than the people in Atlanta on Coca-Cola. Some of the greatest fortunes in United States history were being made in Chattanooga with bottling. So Candler ended up suing these guys and lost. So the Chattanooga billionaires kind of grew and grew. That's where Chattanooga really developed that kind of an intense power structure. The main family behind this eventually was a family called the Luptons. And they became third-generation bottlers in the 80s and 90s when the grandson, Jack Lupton, started to kind of do a turnaround in the city. Chattanooga had a renaissance. Its downtown got renewed, or urban renewal, that sort of thing. And we were a struggling city. We were declared the most polluted city in the world or in the country by Walter Cronkite in 1969. And then the Scions and some of the power structure people kind of got together and said, we got to clean up our city. It's a mess. And so Jack Lupton was a big leader in that. And so the power structures had some ups and downs in terms of its perceptions. But that's just a brief little snapshot of how the power structure in Chattanooga developed. And just a couple other quick things. The second Lupton, Carter Lupton, when his will was probated, it was the largest will ever probated in the South, and it was larger than Howard Hughes's fortune. And by the 1950s, 60s, Chattanooga had more foundation, charitable foundation money than Atlanta, which is about 10 times larger, and had more foundation money than all the rest of Tennessee. In fact, 75% of Chattanooga's foundation money, I mean, Tennessee's foundation money came out of Chattanooga. So it was just it just became the city with a very disproportionate amount of wealth per capita because of these very few people who had this ability to, some people called it bottling gold. Other people called it, quote, a license to print money, unquote. So just a lot of money in Chattanooga. So you get the idea there. The Chattanooga power structure, quote unquote, is a subject of great lore around here. People think that everything in the city that happens is decided by the power structure. And other people say that that's not true at all. And there's nothing to that. And the truth, of course, is somewhere in the middle. One of the reasons I wrote a book on Chattanooga called Old Money, New South, The Spirit of Chattanooga, it's about a 500-page book. It took me 5 years to write. But one of the reasons I wrote it was to get at that question. You know, is there a power structure? To what degree do they have influence? To what degree do they not have influence? Is it an influence for good or for bad? And so that theme kind of weaves in and out of my book. You know, but it's really, you know, it's a history book about Chattanooga, and it's got all sorts of fun stories, and it kind of leads with the lifestyles of the rich and famous, and talks about these billionaire oligarchs that have, you know, been over the city and how they made their fortunes and how they're all intermarried and all the, you know, crazy stuff with that, and people love all that stuff. So it was a fun thing to write. So starting with the first question, is there a power structure in Chattanooga, and to what degree? Like I said, that question goes back and forth. But one interesting story that helps suggest that there is a power structure and that these folks do have undue influence. Around 1976, I think it was, Chattanooga had kind of a racial unrest, near riots, because the black community, the African-American community, wanted to name a downtown street M.L. King Boulevard. It had been named 9th Street, and this is one of the first places in the country where they were, you know, naming a downtown street M.L. King. So it's not like today where every city has it. It was one of the first times it was happening. And
not Memphis?
I don't know. I don't know the history of M.L. King Boulevard developments.
I think it'd be Memphis.
Yeah, it's one of the first, is what I'm saying. The main guy blocking this from happening was Tommy Lupton, who was Jack Lupton's cousin. And we refer to him as the poor Lupton because he was worth about $100 million. Because Jack was worth at least $1 billion, and some of these others were worth a lot of money. And this is back in, you know, 70s, 80s. So it's, you know, a lot of money, a lot more money now.
I guess when he went over for Thanksgiving dinner, he had to sit at the little table.
That's exactly right.
He only had $100 million, yeah.
He was the poor cousin.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
So, but anyway, he had built in the decrepit downtown, which wasn't anywhere near gentrification. He had built a couple of decent high rises for Chattanooga for office space, and it was a very risky investment for him. And he only had about 8% of it rented when he started the project. And he was very concerned that changing the name of the street to ML King Boulevard at that point in time was going to make it much more difficult for him to get renters in the building, and his investment might fail. And so he told the city commission, which had five people on it, he protested against making the change, and there was a 4-1 vote, very solid, that they weren't going to change it. There was one black commissioner, and he voted for it. He couldn't get anybody to he couldn't get anybody to second his motion, and so there was no vote. But in for all practical purposes, it was 4-1. So things started to heat up more and more, and crowds started to gather in the streets. And one of the policemen, who was a black guy, was in the office with Tommy Lupton, telling him about the crowd down there. He says, that guy over there, he's a convicted arsonist. And this guy over here, he's a convicted murderer who got out of prison a couple years ago. And, the crowd's starting to get bigger and bigger. It's just, it's getting to be kind of a crazy situation. And, he stuck to his guns. Well, what happens next is a couple days later, his cousin, the rich cousin, Jack Lupton, is playing golf over in Monterey, California at Pebble Beach Country Club. He jetted over there to play some golf. He was a big golfer. And he picks up the newspaper, the San Francisco newspaper, whatever it is, and sees this headline in the San Francisco newspaper that says, Lupton blocks ML King name for street change in Chattanooga. And of course, it's an article basically making Tommy Lupton look bad and, the whole thing. And it didn't say Tommy Lupton, it said Lupton. And so Jack Lupton was upset about it. And he didn't like it. He was a little more liberal anyway. And so he made a phone call. And I got this from an African-American judge in Chattanooga who ended up becoming good friends with Jack Lupton in later years. But he talked to Jack Lupton and got the story. But basically, Jack Lupton made one phone call is what this judge said. And he called one of the county commissioners and he said, would you just change the name? Just change the name and get it over with. So the next day, the city commission got together and they voted 5-0 in favor of changing the name to ML King Boulevard. So that gives you a sense that, yes, there were some moneyed power elite that could have undue sway when they felt like they needed to. And I've got other stories that I could tell about that. One benign one is Chattanooga didn't have the racial problems that other cities had to the degree that, Atlanta and Birmingham and Memphis and these other cities kind of had racial riots because the congressman got a tip from the FBI about who the KKK leader was in Chattanooga. He ran a gas station. And so the mayor told him to come up to the mayor's office and see him. And when he got there, it was the mayor, the county judge, the sheriff, the police chief, and the congressman. And they all told him, they said, if you start any trouble, we're going to come after you in a hurry. We're going to park a car by your gas station. And the first time we hear anything that happens to you, we're going to lock you up. So that was another instance where the powers that be kind of took matters into their own hands for a more benign purpose. Another thing you heard a lot there was a pastor of the big Fountainhead Presbyterian Church, First Presbyterian Church, named Dr. James L. Fowle. And all the billionaires were in his church. And he was famous for gathering them in a room and saying, hey, we've got to raise $15 million for the United Way. And all the money's right here in this room. He had 10 guys in the room. And he wouldn't let them out until they'd all, volunteered for how much money they were going to give. So the whole United Fund drive could be done by a few people in a room, which is pretty unique for a city. And then one other example I'll give you, which is not benign, is that the captains of industry, these major families, who had undue control for several decades, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, they actually worked against having the city grow. They didn't want growth. And I, for my book, I interviewed their sons, who by the time I interviewed them were, 60, 70 years old. But they said back when they were young men, they would fight with their fathers about trying to get the city to grow. They're like, we got to grow or this, the city's going to have problems. And they're like, oh, no, don't work too hard at that, or you'll bring competitors in here and we're going to have to pay our workers higher wages. So don't do that. And so they would fight with their fathers about it. And of course, when they took over the reins, they changed their tune because they knew that the city was going to die on them, which it started to do in the 60s and 70s. But there was a clear, deliberate, intention by those captains of industry to keep the city from growing too much. So that's a few examples that I can kind of just tell you about the fact that there was a moneyed elite. It's not quite as strong now as it was then. It did exist. It had some good and some bad to it, and that sort of thing. So there's my first salvo. What would you like next?
Anecdotes that are, say, not malign, that are malign?
that are bad?
Yeah.
Let's see here.
It shows outright abuse of power, corrupt,
Yeah, Chattanooga developed a very unusual amount of African-American influence in the late 1800s after the Civil War. There was a very strong alliance between African-Americans and the Republican Party.
This is kind of the Reconstruction period?
Yes. So at some point in like the 1870s, 1880s, the Republican Party was actually headed by a black guy. And I believe half the police force was black. The city was 40% African American. Several state legislators and city aldermen and that sort of thing were African Americans. And so it was quite unusual. At some point, I guess the power structure got tired of it and wanted to see that change. So in 1911, this group of all these moneyed families got together. They started something called the Good Government League. And what they finally accomplished in 1911.
Well, who can be opposed to that?
Yes. Yeah. Good Government League. So in 1911, what they ended up pulling off is they changed the laws in two different accounts. One, before they passed this law, the ballots would have different colors on them so that illiterate people could know who to vote for. But they passed a law saying that you couldn't have any of that, those kind of colored ballots. That doesn't sound too bad. And we're just trying to promote literacy here. But in effect, it took away a lot of the black community's influence in terms of voting. And then the other thing they did, which was really much more destructive, is they changed the city commission, aldermen they called them back then, from being voted in wards or districts to being voted citywide. And so what happened is before that you had several, if not a majority of blacks getting voted ward by ward, but when they changed it to citywide, no blacks got voted anymore into the city commission. So from 1911 to 1971, there wasn't a single black elected official in Chattanooga, or state legislator, any form of government. Whereas before that, it was a strong growing movement. So they were able to tweak the laws and do some things so that the black community couldn't have the strong influence that it had had previously.
Mm-hmm. Now, easy to look at that. Was that racial animus, or was that also a reaction? The corruption during Reconstruction is well known, and often the Reconstruction Republicans, the carpetbaggers, would come down there, and they would put up black politicians as straw men to more or less to raise taxes and carry off with a plunder. And was Chattanooga, like many other southern states, bristling under the boot of Reconstruction, a lot of corruption?
No. In fact, that's one of the things that made Chattanooga unique, is that they actually put an ad out in the paper right after the war, said, "We're welcoming carpetbaggers and other people really? To our city." Yes.
Interesting.
We want to grow, and carpetbaggers, please come. And Chattanooga's moneyed elite ended up really within two or three decades almost completely was carpetbaggers. And they, in other words, northern families having moved down.
Uh-huh.
With the whole industrial manufacturing emphasis and that sort of thing. Chattanooga was known as the dynamo of the South, kind of the Detroit of the South. So, no, it wasn't that. And, you know, sure, was there corruption, involved with some of the politics you're talking about? Yeah, there was, but that, that finds its way all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a valid example of how the elite influence was used for bad. I also heard that one of the moneyed people, when he was young, got into a car wreck because he was drinking too much, and the other person died, and he got off, and his record was expunged. But I got that from a longtime reporter here who's pretty reliable. So, you got those kind of stories too.
Yeah, I was when I listened to your lecture, your talk, it reminded me of a chapter in C. Wright Mills' book, The Power Elite, where he talks about local society. And this kind of is close to what you were saying. He says, the local upper classes, new and old, seen and unseen, active and passive, make up the social backbone of the Republican Party. And this is in local cities. Members of the upper class, however, do not seem as strident or as active politically in the post-war scene as do many of the new. Perhaps it's because they do not feel able, as Allison Davis and others have suggested, the old southern upper classes to lessen the social distances between themselves and the voters. Of course, everywhere their social position is clearly recognized by the officials. They're free from many of the minor legal restrictions, are almost never arrested for drunkenness or minor traffic violations, or are seldom called for jury duty, and usually receive any favors they request. They are, it is true, very much concerned with tax rates and property assessments, but these concerns being fully shared by the newer upper classes are well served without the personal intervention of the old. So here you have, again, your example is, once you're a member of this local elite, the rules, really, at least many of the rules, don't apply to you anymore. Because of your status.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Them that's got, what has the, old song go? I forgot it. I mean, this is you're not telling us anything new here. I mean, there's elites everywhere who get treated more favorably.
Yeah. And he goes up and he opens up the chapter. In every town and small city of America, an upper set of families stands above the middle classes and towers over the underlying population of clerks and wage workers. The members of this set possess more than do others of whatever there is locally to possess. They hold the keys to the local decision. The names and faces are often printed in the local paper. In fact, they own the newspaper, as well as the radio station. They also own the three important local plants and most of the commercial properties along the main street. They direct the banks, mingling closely with one another. They are quite conscious of the fact that they belong to the leading class of leading families. So that's kind of what you were saying.
God bless the child that has his own. That was a good
sense. Oh, really? God bless. So that's the local elite. Now, because of their status, they're also, I guess, assume a leading role in charities and local philanthropy.
Right. You got to keep in mind here that, Chattanooga has an elite, has a very unusually wealthy elite, very, very unusual compared to most cities. But the other thing that we're going to find out here in this podcast is that Chattanooga is very unique because a moneyed elite, by and large, was very heavily influenced by Christianity. And so in Chattanooga, I think it's an outlier. I think it's an anomaly. But in Chattanooga, the influence from Christianity was so strong that this elite was giving away tremendous amounts of money to charity and to churches. And although they're humans, and so there was some bad stuff and some things I've already mentioned, the force for good was much stronger than you're going to find in other cities, and certainly I think on a global level. Let's give some specifics. Chattanooga for years had the highest percentage per capita of giving to the United Way in the country. And it wasn't just the rich people. The reason the city had that distinction is that all the guys who owned the major manufacturing centers would put a slip of paper in the paychecks of their thousands of employees, encouraging them to give to the United Way. And then they started developing a program that all the employees assented to, where they'd take out something out of their paycheck, you know, 1% or half of 1% or whatever it was, just take it, you know, directly out of their paycheck and go give it to the United Way. So it was this strange organized force for charitable giving. You know, I already told you the story about this local pastor who would gather the guys in the room and say, you know, we need to raise $10 million. All the money's in this room. Let's, before we get out of here in the next half an hour, let's figure out who's going to give what. And so all these Coca-Cola billionaires and other manufacturers who are just of extreme wealth, most all of them went to this First Presbyterian Church. And First Presbyterian Church had three pastors that spanned nearly a century of time, who all had this huge ethic of giving, and they basically put the fear of God in these billionaires, and they told them, they said, the reason you exist on this planet is to give away your money. And so that's what many of these you know, oligarchs or elite moneyed people did. Very unusual. And you know, you might want to talk more about foundation money in a minute, Tim, but for those who aren't familiar with what a foundation is, tax-exempt foundations came into being, what, I don't know, 20s, 30s? I'm not sure what the years are.
I think the Rockefeller Foundation opened up business in 1913.
Okay.
So roughly, yeah, that's about right, yeah.
So, but the purpose of a tax-exempt foundation is, this, let's say a guy's got $1 billion, you know, well, today, on today's terms, you know, Bill Gates and Zuckerberg and these guys, they've got, you know, $50 billion, which is an absurd amount of money, which nobody, you know, you'd think you could find a way to spend it, but you probably, you know, really probably couldn't. And so if they take $30 billion of their $50 billion and put it in a tax-exempt foundation, then instead of getting taxed at 50% or 75%, that money gets taxed, you know, at nothing or 2% or something. And the rest of it can be given away to what they want it to be given to. Now, technically, what happens is, so Zuckerberg puts $25 billion into a foundation. He appoints a board of directors. I think the minimum requirement is three. It might be different for different things. It might be five or seven. But, you know, you basically appoint your buddies to a board. And then you start giving away money to your favorite charities. So it's a way to use your money for influence without having to just hand it over to the government and them to give it to places you don't necessarily know where it's going or have any control over. So that's what a tax-exempted foundation is for. And Tim can tell us later how it's been abused by fortunes like Carnegie, Rockefeller, Rothschild, et cetera. But in Chattanooga, it really wasn't the case in Chattanooga that it was actually it was done for the right reasons. These fortunes were set aside, portions of them, for charitable giving. Now, crazy as it was, the Coca-Cola, there's two or three different Coca-Cola families here that put aside some money, you know, for charitable giving, but they kept most of it in their own hands. You know, they didn't want to give away all their money. But there was another family here, still here, called the McClellans. They owned the Provident Life Insurance Company, which merged with Unum I don't know if you've heard of the disability company Unum Provident or Unum. It's the largest disability insurer in the world now. But they had this just gigantically profitable insurance company, and they put like 80% of their fortune in the tax-exempt foundation. And their foundation in Chattanooga was about five times bigger than all the other foundations and the Coca-Cola foundations. And these people were just mega Christian people, starting with their Scottish ancestor back in the 1850s, who signed a covenant with God to devote all his life and resources to God. And then the guy who's running it now is a guy who gets up 5 o'clock every morning and prays and reads his Bible and gives away 70% of his income every year. He says that that's not a sacrifice. He says that somebody giving 10%, you know, middle class person giving 10% of their income to the church is making a far greater sacrifice, but that keeps him from buying Lear jets and yachts and stuff. And so, you know, it's just, this is a guy who doesn't have to do any of this, but he's following God, and his foundation, the McClellan Foundation, is the largest Christian foundation in the world, and every major ministry in the country comes here about twice a year with hat in hand to try to get a grant out of the McClellan Foundation, and they're the largest funder of Christian missions in the world. So it's actually been the foundation law has been used for the good in Chattanooga, but maybe not so much for other large foundations in the country. Tim?
I'm sorry, I had my mute. it makes you think that could this be a function of these elites, local elites, having some sense of local patriotism or loyalty to the areas that they live? So they have an interest in seeing that area develop or do well, their employees do well, and so they're going to do what they think is necessary to make the area prosper. Whereas juxtapose that to maybe the transnational elites who aren't burdened with such, you know, sentimental feelings. They believe in smart money and, you know, quicksilver capital and moving capital from region to region, continent to continent. Manipulating demographics and economics and politics to weaken unions and to exploit labor. So, do you think that that's a reason why they actually have a feeling for the area they live?
Oh, I think that's part of it, but I really wouldn't make it the main reason. I would go once again with the undue Christian influence. You know, another thing, Chattanooga has gotten polled as the most biblical city in the country. The most biblically literate city in the country. And the fountainhead of this thing is this First Presbyterian Church, which started, it sort of became an entity in Chattanooga with the start of a guy named T.H. McCauley, who was the pastor of First Presbyterian during the Civil War. And there's some lore about that, but one of the funny stories about that is that there was a guy praying in the church and doing the Sunday morning prayer or whatever. And as he was praying, some bombs started to go off, and one kind of hit right next to the church, and people started filing out of the church because they were freaking out. But the guy was real pious, and he kept his eyes closed and finished his prayer. And by the time he was done, there was nobody in the church. Another story about T.H. McCauley is that he preached to the town was a Confederate town, and his congregation was filled with a bunch of Confederate soldiers because they were occupying the city. And he preached a sermon, you know, who's on the Lord's side or something, I don't know. Well, the next week, the Union took over Chattanooga, and now his congregation was filled with Union soldiers. But again, they all respected him so much they came to his church, and he preached another sermon. So he preached to both sides fairly. During the battle, his house got overwhelmed with soldiers, and there was 200 soldiers or, you know, 75 soldiers sleeping all throughout his house on the floor. So, you know, that all that was going on. But anyway, he was there during the Civil War. All the pastors left except him. I forgot to tell you about that. He was the only one who stayed because, the city was the city was having a huge battle. There were stories of some of the churches being turned into hospitals. And in front of the church, there was big, huge piles of legs and arms because of all the amputations they had to do. But anyway, this guy was a very godly guy. And he got a little bit sickly about 13 years into his tenure, and he could have kept his position, but instead he stepped aside for his close friend to take it over, a guy named Bachman, Jonathan Bachman, and he had been the chaplain to I can't remember if it was Jackson or Lee, but one of those Confederate demigods, and he was the pastor of the church for like 40 years. And this Macaulay guy went around and started founding churches all over the community. Started starting charities. He founded a bunch of private schools, and he did all these different things. And he his progeny. He had like 16 kids, and his progeny today, like there's this kind of lawyer, one of the real prominent lawyers in town today, who's a Macaulay, and he's kind of liberal. But he told me that when he grew up, his family demanded that they do family devotions every day. It was non-negotiable. But when this great-grandfather of his, who was the Civil War pastor, when he grew up, his father made them do family devotions twice a day, non-negotiable. So I'm trying to give you some anecdotes here and there to try to give you a sense that there was a very unusual Christian influence. And it was these First Presbyterian pastors, starting with Macaulay, that were the ones that put the fear of God in these billionaires and said that your purpose in life is to give away your money. I would go back to that as to why there was a very unusual situation in Chattanooga in terms of philanthropy. If you're asking, is one of the deal breakers or one of the things that will tip the tide for a philanthropist to be a little more benign and helpful in their community, that they're involved in their community and the tide turns with their community. I think that also is a factor, but they can sort of create their own little enclaves that are protected and that sort of thing. So that doesn't, that doesn't necessarily have to be a major motivation.
Mm-hmm. Now in your talk, because you give these stories of a local power structure, and you raise the question of a global power structure. Does it exist? And just like the local power structure, the global power structure, there are people who believe that it's all controlling, like the Illuminati type control. They control everything, or they just there's just undue influence, or because of their immense wealth and their influence. And obviously the answer is somewhere in between and in the middle somewhere, and it's probably closer to the other extreme than it was in a few years ago. But to this vast concentration of wealth, you could argue with the development. Well, as C. Wright Mills argues, is the development of a national economy, the consolidation that the country experienced in the 20th century, particularly because of the Second World War, gave rise to national elites, particularly in corporate America. The military industrial complex, and national politics. And that's what C. Wright Mills concentrates on in his book. But he describes the power elite as the power elite is composed of men whose positions enable them to transcend the ordinary environments of ordinary men and women. They're in positions to make decisions having major consequences, whether they do or do not make such decisions is less important than the fact that they do occupy such pivotal positions that the failure to act, the failure to make decisions is in itself an act that is often of a greater consequence than the decisions they do make. For they are in command of the major hierarchies in organizations of modern society. They rule the big corporations. They run the machinery of the state and claim its prerogatives. They direct the military establishment. They occupy the strategic command post of the local structure. Of the social structure, rather, I'm sorry, which are now centered the effective means of power and the wealth, and the celebrity which they enjoy. This is the country went through a certain transformative experience in the 20th century, growing out some of the events of the 19th century. Obviously, the so-called American Civil War was largely a cause of this, because you gave rise to corporations and national power, the destruction of states' rights or states' power. So he identifies that elite, and so he created a national elite. Since the Second World War, we've developed what the global economy, with the introduction of with the trade agreements, whether it's the General Agreement of Trade and Tariffs, the monetary system, Bretton Woods system, which collapsed in 71, but then gave rise to the petrodollar, and which supports the Anglo-American Western powers and their control of the economy. And you could say this elite is best represented in events or annual meetings like Davos, the World Economic Forum, and particularly Bilderberg.
Right.
So we have this elite.
Yeah. Let me weigh in. I'm not sure where you're headed there, but just from my experience on a local level, I think there's a couple things that need to be taken into account. I think power structures are there locally and globally. To what degree, you have to kind of figure that out. But I think a power structure has more power than it ought to have, perhaps, or it can use its power for the bad, for malevolent reasons, if a couple of things happen. One is if you're just fearful. One, if you're just like, if you're so cynical and fearful that, well, there's nothing you can do, they run everything, or, it's all just spitting against the wind, so I'm just going to sit here and, watch TV and drink beer. If you do that, well, then it's a self-fulfilled prophecy. It'll happen. So that's one thing that you got to be careful of, because there are movements and there are popular efforts. I mean, if you think Brexit wasn't completely some kind of elite psyop, then that's a good recent example. But and then another thing is, I tend to see everything pretty much religious, but if you are degrading as a society or as a human being, sexual debauchery and all sorts of things, you lose your moral fiber, you lose your will to achieve and to succeed and to change and to fight corruption and to fight evil. Well, then, yeah, if that's happening on as both a person and as a local community or as a larger society, then yes, the vipers will creep in and they'll fill the void with an evil power structure that calls the shots, because there's not a moral invigorated populace that's demanding the things be done the right way. So I think here's an analogy with a house. I mean, if you don't take care of your house and aren't looking after it, at some point the bats are going to come in and the rats are going to come in and the cobwebs and the spiders and that's normally what happens if a house isn't occupied or taken care of. Power structures are there. To what degree they have strength is largely dependent on the choices that we make. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean, the individual shouldn't say just because they're malevolent forces and they're corrupt, there's a corrupt power elite, that somehow they're excused from any responsibility in how their lives turn out and how they conduct themselves. But on the other hand, I think brings up the issue of the elites and maybe their exploitation of so-called philanthropy is through the controlling of the arts, the education system, even medicine. There's evidence that strongly suggests there's been an active plan to degrade that society through the domination of such those things, whether it's the promotion of modern art. Good example is if you take over those institutions that promote the arts and you promote a certain type of art, art itself requires a lot of time and money to not only to learn it, to become an expert in it, but also to produce it. And if you make a concerted effort to promote a certain art and marginalize good art or classical art or things that are aesthetically pleasing and uplifting and promote things that are degrading, you can have a certain alchemical effect on society in general. Good example is the promotion of people like Alfred Kinsey by the Rockefeller Foundation.
Yeah, so I'm hearing a chicken and egg sort of thing from you. Is it the elites that cause the populace to become debauched and degraded, or is it a populace that chooses over time a less godly path that creates a void for the elites to rush in and seize the void and take more power? That's a good question. I don't know.
Because throughout history, the history of people like Abby Rockefeller, she was a big promoter of feminism and modern art. And the Rockefellers loved modern art. Now, some people said this is also a good way that the elite will, again, screw everyone over, because through their prestige, their power, they can promote art. And let's say if you're a Rockefeller and you pay $1 million for a piece of crap they call modern art, just the fact that it's in the news that you paid $1 million for it, some sucker out there is going to go out and pay $1.5 million for it. And you can rig markets. That's one thing I've learned, is that we don't have anything close to a free market economy. It's rigged, whether it's Wall Street and the big firms getting 0% loans. These things are rigged. Obviously, the people, man on the street, isn't getting a 0% loan. It's the big corporations, and this also creates further concentration in the economy, which distorts things and also destroys the local economies, local flavor, small town values, and you can really, really mess up a society if you're so determined. Good example of that would be the Rockefeller's interest in education, which was designed to create a nation of workers and not thinkers, and that was a stated objective of the Rockefellers, particularly Frederick Gates, who he was the one who oversaw the funding of the General Education Board back in the turn of the century, into the 20th century. Right back then, Rockefeller donated $139 million to General Education Board to promote compulsory state-funded education. And the goal of that was to dumb people down. And that's the stated objective. I can find the quote here.
Yeah, John Taylor Gatto has done such a good job of exposing all that.
The Underground History of American Education. But the chronology here is interesting. It's the General Education Board was not interested in encouraging critical thinking. Rather, its focus was on organizing children and creating reliable, predictable, obedient citizens. As the award-winning former teacher John Gatto puts it, school was looked upon from the first part of the 20th century as a branch of industry and a tool of governance. And that's why they funded so generously the General Education Board. I have this quote by Frederick Gates, if I can find it.
There's that one quote where they say that they're looking for good worker bees, but 7% of the population is going to be designated to do actual critical thinking or something.
Yeah, yeah. Here we go. This is Frederick Gates in the Country School of Tomorrow, occasional paper. The Country School of Tomorrow, Frederick T. Gates. He says, "In our dream, we have limitless resources, and the people who yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. The present educational convention fades from our minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive rural folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or of science. We are not to raise up among them authors, orators, poets, or men of letters. We should not search for an embryo of great artists, painters, and musicians, nor will we cherish even the humbler ambition to raise up from among them lawyers, doctors, preachers, and statesmen, of whom we are now have ample supply."
Well, there you go. Yeah.
I mean, so, pretty malevolent intentions here. And if you look at the course of history, it turns out this has been the course of philanthropy. Isn't so much to give and help people. It's to help society and promote education, make a better world. It's to gain control of it, and you could gain a large measure of control through these tax-free foundations by taking over the arts, investing in entertainment. The Rockefellers did that. And if you look about the biography of the Rockefellers, there's an American Experience one about the Rockefellers that ran about maybe 20 years ago. And it really just is hagiography about how, you know, the Rockefellers, how they dealt with their wealth and how the second generation became devoted to bettering mankind, how they managed this vast fortune. It's interesting enough that the biography itself, the show itself, was brought to you by ConocoPhillips, the oil company, which is a, you know, outgrowth of Standard Oil.
Sure. Now, when every time you say Rockefeller Foundation, you could also generally say Carnegie Foundation. Mm-hmm. And
from what I understand, they took Rockefellers took over the Carnegie Foundation. Yeah, that's another thing. Same with the Ford Foundation, by the way.
Yeah, and I have a personal connection to Andrew Carnegie. Let me tell you that story. I just finished making a full feature documentary just about 2 years ago that premiered at our local IMAX theater. Half of it's about my great grandparents. He was a Jewish doctor in Hollywood, and he and his wife were promoting socialism and free sex way before it was cool at the turn of the century. And things kind of got out of hand, and she got depressed and wanted him to quit doing the free sex, and he didn't want to quit. Imagine that. And so she started getting depressed, quote unquote, and then she had a tumor, quote unquote. And then in 1922, she died as a middle-aged woman, suddenly on the operating table, the day after the operating table in the recovery room. And but the nurse overseeing the recovery room was one of my great-grandfather's lovers. And the more we look into the story, the more it looks like it was early assisted suicide. So it's a morality tale from my perspective. And they were hanging out. They were really good friends with like Emma Goldman and Margaret Sanger and Clarence Darrow and all the great radicals of the first part of the 20th century. But so the movie's most kind of half about that, but then half of it is about this doctor's grandfather, who's my third great grandfather, whose name was Theodore Tuttle Woodruff, who invented the sleeping car and was responsible for the start of Andrew Carnegie's fortune. And so how that story goes is Theodore Tuttle Woodruff was this cool little inventor. And so he invents the sleeping car. And Andrew Carnegie was one of the early investors in his company. And he tells the story, Carnegie, in his autobiography. He says, I was on a train one day, and I walked back into one of the train cars, and there was this little man back there with a little green bag, and he pulled this model car out of his bag and showed me his idea for a sleeping car. And Carnegie says, all of a sudden at once, I had this aha moment, and I was like, wow, here's the future before me, and this is going to be fantastic. And so he talks about how he turned it into this thriving company, and he says that was the beginning of his fortune. Well, the truth is, T.T. Woodruff had already built a whole bunch of sleeping cars, and they were operating on 20 different railroads when he first met Carnegie. So Carnegie made up the whole story. Carnegie did, in fact, make his start of his fortune off of Woodruff. And what happened was Woodruff was in litigation with George Pullman. George Pullman, of course, it ended up being called the Pullman sleeping car. Mm-hmm. George Pullman started making his own sleeping cars and stole the patent from Woodruff, and it was illegal. And so Woodruff was suing him in court, and Carnegie was one of Woodruff's investors. And when he had bought enough of the stock and had got some other friends where he had controlling interest, he kicked out Woodruff, and he went and made a deal with Pullman and merged and took over the whole industry. And that's how he became the robber baron, aptly named. So meanwhile, Woodruff is fighting these guys and doesn't have enough money, because they've got all these high-priced lawyers. He writes a few years later, he writes this big, long letter to the editor piece in the Philadelphia paper. And just after that happens, he's in a Philadelphia train yard. He's been in train yards all his life. He's very familiar with them, but he gets suddenly struck by a train and dies. Carnegie's main biographer, the way he puts it. He says, so when this happened, Carnegie, who liked tidy endings, could move on and not have to worry anything more about T.T. Woodruff.
Yep.
So, anyway, I have a personal connection to Carnegie and the robber barons.
Well, like so, behind every fortune, there's a great crime. I think Balzac said that. And again, what it is, it isn't to begrudge a man his rightfully earned wealth, but it sends me when you get to get that big, you have to engage in things that are both illegal and immoral, because otherwise, I think the market itself, the truly free market, it tends to militate against great concentrations and big business, unless you have some sort of like cartel situation or you can manipulate the regulatory process, regulatory capture. And this is why big business is always like big government, because the two go hand in hand. And they both, I think, rely on ultimately crime and violence to maintain their vast size, you know.
So I would go back to the Christian or religious aspect again and again, because Carnegie was an atheist. And Carnegie, you know, if the story that I told, if you can draw the conclusions I'm suspecting, you know, he was not a moral man. He was not a Christian man. He was an atheist. And so he takes his great fortune and his foundation, and it's not going to be used for the same uses that some of these Chattanooga billionaires that I talked about use their money for. And then you take someone like Rockefeller, who funded the modernist, and then brought to his church the guy who is promoting the ideas that all the major tenets of Christianity are false. Who cares about the resurrection? Who cares if Jesus even existed? Let's just talk about some of the moral teachings in the Bible. You know, this is who Rockefeller aligned himself with. So he's not a good man. He's not a Christian man. And so his fortune and his foundation is going to be used for malevolent purposes as well. And so, you know, that religious bent, I think, is all important.
Well, yeah, it keeps you, if you're worried about the hereafter, and all you think, all that matters is the here and now, it's going to shape how you behave. For many people, especially people who have such extreme ambition and greed. Other people are checked by ethical or moral concerns or just by their own limitations. But these men are obviously very driven, hard-driven, ruthless men, and they're gangsters. More or less. The same fate befell the guy Diesel, right? The guy who invented diesel fuel. He was traveling across the English Channel to meet with representatives of the big oil company, Standard Oil, and because he developed fuel derived from I guess plant oil. And for some reason he fell over the side of the boat, and they took over his patent for diesel, and diesel became petroleum based. So funny how that works.
Yeah. Another guy that died suspiciously with Carnegie and his right hand man, a guy named Henry Clay Frick. he was the head manufacturer or something. I don't know. He ran the whole plant.
But he was at the homestead, right?
Right. But this guy had owned many of the patents for the technology they were using to make steel. And one day he died in the furnace blast. And then Carnegie was able to buy all his patents for cents on the dollar. So that was another suspicious death that happened. And then, of course, you're referring to the homestead riots, which was another blight on Carnegie's fortune.
And with Rockefeller's, there was the Ludlow Massacre, which the bad press from that induced them to hire Ivy Lee, I think, as PR. And he came with the idea of the Rockefeller Dimes and the idea of charity. And I guess it's no coincidence the Rockefeller Foundation, the tax-exempt foundation, opened up for business in 1913, the same year, of course, that they passed the federal income tax law.
One story I wanted to mention to you is so Carnegie and his right hand man Frick, they right after the Homestead riots, I think they had a falling out, and so they became bitter enemies the last 20 years of their life. And as Carnegie was starting to die, he was getting conscience stricken, and he wanted to make amends with Frick. And they both lived in New York, you know, near Central Park or something. And so Carnegie sent one of his guys to deliver a letter to Frick, seeing if he would meet with him. And Frick sent him back a letter, and he says, "You can tell Carnegie," he says, "I'll be happy to meet with him." He says, "I'll meet with him in hell where we're both going."
Really?
Yeah.
That's something that says a lot. Wow.
That's on the record, yeah.
That reminds me of that movie with Tom Hanks and Paul Newman, where Tom Hanks played the hitman, Road to Perdition.
Yeah, I didn't see it, yeah.
And there's a scene where he's talking to Paul Newman, and they're talking about the life they have chosen is that, you know, you always hear in mob movies, this is the life we have chosen.
Right.
And he goes, "You and I both," there's some reference to heaven. I forget the context, but Paul Newman looks at him rather sternly and goes, "You and I both know we will never see the face of God."
Yeah, same kind of thing, right?
Kind of like it's this Faustian bargain that they make, and might explain the overall values of the elite, where they've chosen sides, and you know, they said, "Well, I'll give you dominion over all the powers and principalities if you bow before me," and they made a different choice than Jesus made.
Yeah, well, getting back to the Chattanooga story a little bit, one of the interesting turns in the story with Chattanooga is, you know, I told you about this Lupton family that was three generations of billionaire oligarchs, you know, owning and making more money off Coca-Cola than anybody in the world. In fact, the first Lupton, I forgot to mention, he had a mansion that was 34,000 square feet, had an indoor swimming pool, a bowling alley, and all sorts of, you know, ballrooms and stuff. It was kind of like the Biltmore over there. It burned down tragically, but so Jack Lupton, the third one in the line, the grandson, he kind of went against the grain. Wasn't really so Christian oriented as the rest of them. And there's this offhand mention in the history of the First Presbyterian Church that in 1967, some plaster on the roof of the church fell down onto the Lupton pew. it's just an offhand reference, you know, just like, you know, some dumb church history. But I used it as a metaphor for the fact that right around that time, Jack Lupton started to show that he didn't have the same interest in Christian stuff as his forebears did and his peers did. And he took the foundation, which had been chaired by Dr. Fowle, that Presbyterian pastor that would gather everybody in the room, and he became the chairman of his foundation himself. He called it the Lyndhurst Foundation, which is the name of that mansion that I told you that burned down. So Jack Lupton took over the Lyndhurst Foundation, and all the giving changed immediately. It went to all these kind of Christian charities and that sort of thing, and he immediately began funding more kind of liberal and leftist causes. And so it was one of the breaks in kind of the way Chattanooga had moved. However, one of the things he also did is he became a pioneer in blazing the trail for the renewal of the downtown and the gentrification and renaissance of Chattanooga. And so he's sort of a dual-edged sword because that was really that was a good thing. But he just kind of had some various sides to him. But so Chattanooga now kind of has, the two paths. You got the conservatives and the liberals kind of battling it out at the elite level.
Now, we get the issue of elite. Now, you mentioned the how they live, a certain lifestyle. I was looking at the Rockefeller estate up in New York, just pictures on the internet, and I don't know if you can live in a place like that without developing some sort of contempt or separation from the plights of the vast majority of humanity and start to see yourself as sort of, you know, being above it all, above the fray. Again, it's hard to – how does one – live in such opulence and such distance from the rest of humanity and expect to have any empathy for the vast, you know, for the unwashed masses.
Yeah, I'd say you're probably right. Now, and I'll just tell you, in Chattanooga, we didn't really have that phenomenon. The elites here were a little more accessible, and you know, they're not flying helicopters, and and they're living in a little bit more reasonable places and that sort of thing.
The there was a movie called A Bronx Tale with Chaz Palminteri and Robert De Niro. It's a story of a mobster who befriends a teenager, and it's one of these, you know, I guess you could say mythologized or you could say idealized portrayal of the mafia, of a local mobster. Nevertheless, it does show the very violent side of it and all that. But he's explaining to the kid, to the teenager, the Chaz Palminteri plays the gangster, why, you know, he's a kind of a mid to high level gangster, runs his own crew. But the area he operates, he lives in the neighborhood that he operates in. He says other gangsters have moved out and they don't care. And this is the area that the drugs are moving in and all that stuff. Well, he lives in the neighborhood that he operates in, and he has an interest in, although he's the elite, I guess you could say, in that area, and he's the local crime boss. And so long as you don't cross them and you respect them, life is pretty predictable, you know. But his point is, I live in my neighborhood, and I want to see my neighborhood do well. What he thinks is doing well, but bottom line is, he doesn't want to see it go to pot. Whereas some of these transnational elites where, you know, if you know, if you're a Rothschild or you're, you know, even a Meyer Lansky or something, you can live in Canada, you can live in the United States, you can live in Israel, you can live in Switzerland. And same with the Rockefellers, you know, it's the idea of some of the decisions they take at Bilderberg or at Davos, where they make these decisions regarding currency, or should we take down an economy, should we deindustrialize, should we embark on a 20-year plan to destabilize China, then industrialize it so it can become the workhouse of the world, and should we shift trade back or industry back to the United States, and all this. They're, you know, more or less they're moving humanity around like pawns, where they take their decisions. At the same time, they're in a position to control things like monetary policy, tax policy, to start a war, to destabilize the Middle East, to cause a migrant crisis in Europe, you know. So it's almost like, you know, again, they have no real concern or love for their community. They don't have a community. They're transnational. You know.
Right. And, you know, and I have no analogy for that here, because the elites here have very much been tied to the city of Chattanooga. And so they have cared about their community.
But it's interesting that you made a story that at one level, there was a generation that wanted to keep Chattanooga relatively poor, so they could control it.
So they didn't have to pay their employees higher wages.
Yeah. So they're gonna exert their influence to retard development, to hold it back, because they see themselves. Although you could argue that the community itself might do better with the growth, their relative status would be weaker if it did grow, because it'd invite competition and things like that. So that's almost like it's being treated like a fiefdom.
Right.
And none of this, again, that power is nowhere represented in law itself, right? There's no law that says we control things. They're operating behind the scenes. It's not really talked about openly, but it's understood.
By the way, I had a news publication in Chattanooga in the early 90s, and I used to write about that. You know, once in a while, I'd hearken into the fact that, you know, the elites were trying to keep the city from growing back in the day, and I'd be called names and a conspiracy theorist and all that kind of stuff. And so when I wrote this book and started interviewing the sons of these captains of industry, they confirmed everything that I'd written.
So the conspiracy theorist was proved right.
Yeah, I like to call myself a corruption theorist. it works a whole lot better.
Well, it's just like when we talk about the Bilderberg or the Rockefellers and David Rockefeller and what he's up to. And he's a globalist. He wants to, you know, go out and he wants to weaken American sovereignty, and he wants to create world government. Well, you know, he's admitted as much in his own biography. I think on page 405 he admits that. I stand accused of being a globalist, of, you know, such and such, and of that charge I am guilty. And he boasted in his own biography about that.
Yeah, what a goofball. Why did he do that?
Yeah, here it is. It goes, it's like Larry Silverstein or something. But here we go. Here's the quote here. It says, we are grateful to the Washington Post, New York Times, Time Magazine, and other great publications whose directors have attended our meetings and respected their promises of discretion for almost 40 years. It would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world. Is that a conspiracy? If we had been subjected to the lights of publicity during those years. But the world is more sophisticated and prepared to march towards a world government. The supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers are surely preferable to the national auto-determination practiced in past centuries. Now, that quote is so perfect. I that's got to be like a fake quote. You know. And he goes, this is on page 405. Here's the quote I was talking about. Page 405 of his memoirs. He says, David Rockefeller writes, some even believe we, Rockefeller family, are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure. One world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty and I am proud of it.
Well, there you go.
And of course, the way these people operate is, you know, if you're a Rockefeller or a Rothschilds or, you know, you're not going to control every little aspect of politics, but you're going to exert basic control over the big issues. We can argue over trivial things, but basically, the system itself is never challenged or questioned until it has to be changed on their terms. This is how you're going to. You're going to make sure that both political parties are in the fold, which is what Kara Quigley talks about in Tragedy and Hope. You know, the false left-right paradigm, and it's very easy to buy. If all you have are two major parties, it's very easy to buy them up. You know, and control them. It's very easy. Once you have wealth, it's very easy to leverage it politically and amass more wealth. And it goes back and forth.
Did you read that book while you were interviewing Jade, or did you just interview Jay?
Oh, I just interviewed Jay. I have not. I mean, I've read maybe a couple hundred pages out of the book.
Same here.
To sit back and read that book, that's why Jay Dyer deserves people's support for going through that book examining it the way he has.
It's like that old cereal commercial, let Mikey do it.
Yeah. And I joked with Jay, I said, hey, that's why I support Jay's work. I pay you $4.95 a month, so I don't have to read that tome.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, he did some movie review, some horrible movie, and I said, Jay, I want to thank you for going to see crappy movies like this. I don't have to waste my time and money. that's one of the things that we talk about, a global superclass, and for some reason people still think it's conspiratorial to think that it exists. But of course, I've mentioned C. Wright Mills' book, The Power of the Elite, that he writes about a national elite that kind of came into the fore in the aftermath of the Second World War. Just, I guess, 10 years later, I mentioned Carol Quigley. He wrote, The Tragedy and Hope, and in that book, and Craig Quigley wasn't Gary Allen. He wasn't he was a real scholar. He was at Georgetown University. He was the mentor of Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton mentions Quigley in his acceptance speech at the Democrat National Convention in 1992. Yeah, I think he did work for the Smithsonian Institute, for the Congress. So he was a real heavy hitter intellectually. He was a real academic, and he was in the establishment. Of course, Tragedy Hope itself is sort of an apologetic for the insiders. So he's telling the Atlanticist perspective. It's supposed to be like a guidebook, or tell people who are going to work at the State Department, who are going to work at CIA, who are going to be at CFR, hey, this is our plan, this is how it works. So he has access to all their documents, and he, I think, for the better part of 20 years, researched it and wrote this book, this tome, Tragedy and Hope.
Is he still alive?
No, he died in 1977.
In 77?
Yeah, 1977. He was like 65, 66 years old.
So he didn't even have time to really kind of weigh in years later on, the reaction to his book and even backpedal and say, well, I didn't really mean what I said or something.
Well, there's an interview. I did an interview with Kevin Cole last year on an article called The Professor That Said Too Much. And Kevin Cole's article about it is The Article That Said Too Little, where he's interviewed by Washington Post reporter Rudy Maxa, I think is his name, who's kind of like an entertainment reporter or something. So the reporter didn't know really to ask the meaningful questions. I mean, that's no shock there. They never do. But in that interview, and you can get it, it's online, he talks about he was upset because a lot of the conspiracy theorists had taken up his book because the book itself was reportedly suppressed because it leaked out and it started to sell more than they intended it to be. And so what happened was there were orders going out for it, and the publisher was saying was telling Quigley that that it was that no one wanted it, but the orders were going out for it, and the publisher was telling the bookstores that the plates are no longer available. So at some level, it was decided that the book was revealing too much. It had gotten out. They didn't expect it to go be as popular as it was. So it became pirated for many years. It's in print now. But he's talking about this in this interview, and he's upset about that. He also said that the publisher had destroyed the plates. He said this is once a book is no longer out of print, the plates revert to the author. That's what the contract and the law calls for. But nevertheless, they destroyed the plates. So there appeared to be an active effort to suppress the book. And he talks about it in the interview. Then in several points in the interview, he says, I can't talk about this now because I fear for my life, or I fear to talk about this, implying either his career or his life is in jeopardy if he reveals too much what he's talking about. So the book, although it wasn't designed, wasn't intended to be like a tell-all, or I mean, a whistleblower book. It was supposed to be in-house. It got out, and so it started to disseminate too much. And that's when it was reportedly suppressed. But in that interview, Quigley is fearful of some power ruining his career if he talks too much about things. And you can definitely get that sense in the interview. Like, well, who's gonna harm you if you say this? We live in a free country, right? Why would you be?
I wonder if anybody has gone line by line through the early books and the late printings to see if there's any changes.
I think they have. There were some pirated couples that were changed or things lacking. But then the 1980 early 80s, the Anglo-American Establishment was published posthumously under his direction. Apparently, he didn't want to publish till after he died, and that names names. I haven't read that book yet either. I intend to. Apparently, that's an easier read than Tragedy and Hope. That's when it names names, like the actual people involved in this, in designing the system. Quigley himself, and this is very, he talks about, he says, during the past two centuries, when peoples of the world were gradually winning their political freedom from the dynastic monarchies, the major banking families of Europe and America were actually reversing the trend by setting up new dynasties of political control through the formation of international financial combines. These banking dynasties had learned that all governments must have sources of revenue from which to borrow in times of emergency. They had also learned that by providing such funds from their own private resources, they could make both kings and democratic leaders tremendously subservient to their will. And, of course, if you stir up emergencies, you stir up the demand for more money, you can loan more money, and you make more money. Of course, this is all based on the fractional reserve banking system and interest rates. You actually, you create money as you loan it out, and you charge interest on it. And that's endless. Revolving debt. This gets bigger and bigger and bigger until you gain control of the entire economy, the global economy. That seems to be what's happened, with these families. So I don't think it's a question that this elite exists. It's a question of to what extent they control things. I think to a large extent they control the big picture. David Rothkopf wrote a book called Superclass. There's an elite group of about 6,000 people who control things. They go to the same schools, go to the same parties, belong to the same secret societies, I guess you could say, and they intermarry, and they control every major bank in the world. And by controlling all the economic power, they're going to basically control the political power. Someone, if you think democracy really works, that's like saying my vote matters as much as David Rockefeller's. If you believe that, then you believe in democracy.
Right, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I don't know about this elite of 6,000. I mean, there could be some truth to that, but I don't really know.
Yeah. Well, there have been studies through interlocking directorates of corporations. If you find all the major corporations are controlled by a very small group of individuals, you know, who, again, go to the same parties, go to the same club, intermarry. And so there's a sort of like a breakaway civilization effect going on here.
Well, maybe that could be my next book. You know, my book on Chattanooga has this pullout chart that shows how all the elite are married to each other.
Yeah.
The whole thing is completely connected. It goes, it folds out about six sheets, and it goes from one side to the next, around the back, all the way to the very end, and it starts and ends with the same people. Mm-hmm. So they're all connected somehow.
And there's always been, we heard those rumors that Bill Clinton is actually with Rockefeller's illegitimate son.
Yeah, I've heard that.
That's a possibility. He got around. He was the governor of Arkansas. You know, I can see that. But, you know, but it goes way back. I mean, I was reading, Commodore Perry, you know, the guy who opened up China or Japan to the West with his gunboats in the 1850s.
Yeah.
Well, his daughter was married to August Belmont, who was the Rothschild agent and reportedly illegitimate son of one of the Rothschilds. August Belmont was the one that advocated. Isn't he one that started the Manifest Destiny and all that? And so a lot of that was urged on by the banking families, the Rothschilds. And there's also some question of whether the Rothschilds were behind aggravating the fissures between the North and the South to precipitate the so-called American Civil War, because they anticipated Lincoln borrowing money to pay for the war.
Well, I heard that the rumor that Hitler might have been a Rothschild, but so you're telling me that Lincoln might have been a Rothschild.
Oh no! Lincoln.
I'm playing, having fun.
But I thought the Commodore Perry link to the Rothschilds was rather interesting. Direct link: his daughter married into the Rothschild line, and he's over there opening up Japan, you know. And that would factor big into what was going on in Asia in the 20th century, because Japan itself was sort of a closed feudal society until the gunboats showed up, and they saw what was happening in China, and they knew they had to modernize, and they modernized, and they became, for the better part, I guess, of 30 years, they were kind of the Anglo-American cat's paw in Asia until they got too big for their britches, and came up with the idea of Asia for Asians, and that's when, you know, when America went to war with them. All of a sudden, Japan, you know, was an imperialist, and you know how the English and the French and Americans hate imperialism. So
right, that's right.
I think there was one Japanese diplomat when FDR was putting the pressure on Japan for its policies in Asia that said, just when we learned to play poker, they changed the game to bridge. I thought that was a good pithy way to put it, you know.
Hypocrisy
of it all. So, I think the big difference here with the global elite, I think what you're telling is, again, with Chattanooga, you have kind of they're local, and they have a sense of proportion to things as of their Christian faith, and so they're inhibited, morally inhibited, and they have a Christian sense of charity and decency about them, despite their vast wealth.
Right.
Whereas I don't think if you look at the global elite, whether it's the Rothschilds or the Rockefellers, or the DuPonts, these characters, I don't think the entity they worship.
Right. Well, I think I think it's a little more glaring than that because. I think when you have that much wealth, you know, the decision you make in your heart of you know, which God you're going to follow is going to have much more drastic repercussions and consequences than your kind of average middle class person. So you know, for the Chattanooga elite, that Christian faith moved them in a certain direction in a very strong way. But if you're a billionaire and you don't have any commitment to God, like you said, you don't care about, you know, you're not worried about repercussions for the afterlife, and you begin to move in another direction. And the human heart, you know, if you're a conservative and you're, you know, have a Christian worldview, the human heart kind of bends towards evil if it's not redeemed and constrained. And so when you've got that, you know, when the resources are that large and you can just do anything that your heart desires, and the heart tends to move towards lusting after anything that comes across its path, and then it lusts after power, then making that choice in your heart, it really has major consequences for moneyed elite.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, well, again, getting back to the, well, yeah, it's, if you, once you reach that level, I think you start to want to, I guess, become your own god. And you get that with transhumanism, I guess, today. With a lot of the elites apparently are funding, looking into things about life extension and this guy, you know, Google and Ray Kurzweil, you know, uploading your consciousness or your maybe they wouldn't call it a soul, but they call it consciousness, up to some supercomputer where you can live forever, you know. And so I think with vast wealth and vast power, not only do you become incorrigibly corrupt, you also go insane.
Yeah, and, you know, and wanting a one-world government just totally makes sense. That's naturally where anybody would go if they had that much power and that much money and had the ability to start pulling the strings to move in that direction.
Well, that's what the evidence suggests, because I think are you familiar with Norman Dodd and the Rees Committee researchers in the 20th century?
I think I've heard you talk about it a few times.
Well, what they discovered was exactly that with the foundations, with the Carnegie and the Rockefeller foundations. I think this particular was a Carnegie Endowment for Peace, but the idea was Rockefeller would handle domestic and Carnegie would handle international. But it was that they were investigating this committee looking for communist infiltration. They thought they were chasing communists, but that was only one level. Really, was happening with what Norman Dodd uncovered. He sent her investigator Catherine Casey, I think was her name, to investigate, look at the minutes of the Carnegie Foundation, and for looking for subversion. You know, what are they doing? She was like, "Well, the Carnegie Foundation, these foundations are charitable." Her attitude was, "They do great work. What am I looking for?" You know. But she went up. She was skeptical. Maybe it was a mistake, but they gave her full access to the meetings dating from 1909 up until the present day. And what she uncovered, she had a nervous breakdown because it was such a it was shattering her paradigm, how she thinks how the world works. But what she uncovered was a plan to fuse. One thing was to subject the country to a series of shocks and conflicts, particularly wars, to fundamentally change the country. To collectivize it, and once the eventually there was a plan to fuse East and West with the communist world and the so-called capitalist West, and that's the Fabian model. But she uncovered this plan, and this is through the foundations, you know, through their control of the arts, through education, through the CFR, and the CFR is again a good example of how it's done. It gives you the mechanics of how how public discourse, how policy is controlled, you know, all behind the scenes.
What year was this that Dodd?
This was the 1950s. But 1950s. Her research dates back as far back as 1909 when discussions of war.
Sure, yeah, but this is the 50s. And Dodd was a congressman?
Dodd was the investigator of the Rees Committee. Rees Committee was a congressional committee looking into the foundations because they're worried that they were been infiltrated by communists. And again, what they were identifying was sort of this international conspiracy that they identified. They might have first thought it was communist, like McCarthy, what McCarthy was onto, but it was something much more deep, much more sinister, really. Because what's really onto was ultimately, I think what they're ultimately onto was the Round Table plan.
Right.
Which I mentioned to you, I think I talked to you in my interview with you about the fusing of the reconquest of the United States, the reincorporation of the United States, the ambition of Cecil Rhodes to create a global empire controlled by the English-speaking peoples under British tutelage, you know? And that's what the idea, that's what the whole ambition of the Rhodes Trust.
Did McCarthy stumble into that stuff as well, or did he just always think it was communism?
I think he just always thought it was communism, but he was only seeing part of the truth. He was also put onto it by, Hoover at the FBI, who didn't like the fact that the CIA had been created, and didn't like that a lot of his turf was being, trampled on by the Pentagon and the CIA. So there's a lot of bureaucratic infighting that explains that, but you know, and so, and Quigley talks about that, and because I was talking to Jay Dyer about that, about a lot of the communist cells were simply fake, put out in the news to create fear. Some were real, like the Green Glass Circle. That's what the Rosenbergs were part of. But I've interviewed like the Collins brothers about the atomic weapons. And how proliferation was actually desired by the elite to create global fear, to create the pretext for global government.
Yeah. You know?
So things are very different than they appear, you know.
Yeah, creating the cells, that's some things never change, do they?
Yeah. So, but yeah, if you do the research, there is the evidence there to show that there obviously is a global elite who control national governments through their controlling of the financial system, ultimately, and that's what Quigley writes about. You know, so they're not like your local elites, not at all. You know.
Yeah, they're there. Same kind of thing as they have the power to the degree that. The culture is declining, I would say.
Yeah.
And I what you said about how they're sort of at a higher level, so you know you can buck the system and cross them in certain ways on lower levels, fighting communism, so to speak. But if you start cracking the code at a higher level, you're not going to last long.
Yeah, you can go so high, you know. And long as your activism is within the system itself. I mean, you left or right, and long as this is your infighting, your criticism is occurring within that system, they can tolerate it because it's a dialectic that they can control and manipulate in some way. And which we see, I think, what we see today with. The development of white nationalism, it's a response to a real problem, a problem that is being aggravated deliberately by the power elite, whether it's in Europe here or in the United States. You know, demographic warfare, population disruptions, and you can sit back and, you know, create an arena for fighting and just watch everyone duke it out and out of a chaos order, right? That's a Freemasonic approach, so... And that's what's occurring. So you can, if you get people asking the wrong questions, you don't have to worry about the answer. I think that's what they want people doing. And so that's what you have. I think a lot of what's going on in Europe is intentionally to destabilize these countries. Create a situation where everyone's infighting, and then you can that in itself becomes an argument for stronger European Union as the nation states break down. You know,
I'd like to think that there's some aspects of Trump's agenda that really is aggravating the elites, and cracking down, you know, with the when he says we're going to have. Well, he doesn't say strong police state. What does he say? We're going to have what's the phrase that he's used? Crack the whip. But anyway, he's talked about stronger police force.
Yeah.
And that would fit into the dialectic, but I'm not so sure that his fair trade emphasis is necessarily on line with what the elite's agenda. And I'm certain that his common sense, knee-jerk desire to have decent diplomatic relationship with Russia is not part of the elite agenda. So,
yeah.
I'm not. I'd like to think that there's certain parts of what he's doing that is not fitting in with the overall agenda.
But also, there's most of the chance there's a faction within the elite who realize the neoconservative faction is insane, and they have to be reined in, and that might signal why Trump is tolerated. That they're this faction is not monolithic. There are factions within this elite, and I have to think that there are some people who are looking at one faction saying, "You're crazy. You want to pick a fight with Russia. We're overextended. It's too. We need to regroup. We need to draw it back a little bit." And I like maybe that's why his candidacy was allowed to go through.
Yeah, because Henry Kissinger would be in that camp.
Mm-hmm. And whereas people like the neoconservatives, like the Kagans, and these are, of course, those are just functionaries. This is like in your talk, I was looking at, you had a scene from The Godfather.
Yes.
Around the table, and this is kind of like how the world really functions. The world is a criminal syndicate, more or less, and the different factions, different families. It's like the Gabinos, the Lucchesis, and what's the other family? One of the other families up there, and they have
Corleone.
They have different factions, and they work things out, and there's fighting, there's bloodletting sometimes, but ultimately they have to come together and work things out. So I think that's that. Unfortunately, or fortunate, or whether it's unfortunate or fortunate, I don't have a seat at their table, so I can only speculate with the information that I have at my disposal. But I have to think. I think it was Catherine Austin Fitz said, if you want to know how the world works, is you have to watch all three Godfathers. So my response was that, even the third one. Okay.
Have you seen the third one?
Yeah, I did. When it wasn't that good.
Yeah, that was my favorite. Okay.
but it was. They say what it is. I saw it when I was in my 20s, and I probably enjoy it a lot more now. the other two are better movies, but the third is more revelatory, I think, because you have Michael Corleone going legit, and what does he do? He creates a foundation.
Yeah, that's true. That's right.
So, well, listen, I think we've talked about this. We've covered a lot here. Anything else you want to say? Any observations or anything else? Anything we missed or anything?
No. This book that I've been talking about is out of print, so we can't promote it tonight. But you can go to globalstoryline.com to hear some of my podcasts and also some of the articles that I've written about other things. So that's if you want to read more of my stuff, globalstoryline.com.
You just started that podcast, right?
Just about a month ago. Yeah.
Okay. And there, so you have a few, you've past interviews, I guess past interviews you've done, or different events you've posted up there, and more recent interviews, of course, with yours truly appearing on one, Jay Dyer, and it goes most recently, James Perloff on Christian Zionism, right?
That's right. And then I'm about to post an interview with E. Michael Jones on Logos versus Anti-Logos. I might give it a different sexy title. I haven't figured that out yet. I've also got some articles on there that I've written dealing with Ethiopia, 12 things that Ethiopian Christians can teach American Christians, 21 reasons to be an Orthodox Christian. I've got an article on what the Bible has to say about monarchism versus democracy. And I've got an article about my book, Hillary and Vince. So if you want to get that book about Hillary Clinton and Vince Foster and that whole sordid affair, go to Amazon.com and type in Hillary and Vince.
Okay. Great. Well, listen, Dean, thanks for coming on the show again.
Always fun.
Yeah, so maybe we'll talk again soon. I know that if you write more about one of these days, I'd like to talk about monarchy and democracy. And I know that's an interesting talk right there, because we're trained to think, of course, democracy is the pinnacle of, I guess, political civilization. Now, that's what we all need. But in reality, it's the I think in a final analysis, people were much freer under monarchies than they're under our Masonic or republics or democracies today.
Yeah, no, that'd be a fun one to do. I'm not an expert on monarchy. I wrote a long article on what the Bible has to say about monarchy versus democracy, so I can talk about that. But maybe bring in a third person who has more of the political governmental angle, and it'd be fun.
Yes. So, well, listen, thanks a lot, Dean.
Okay.
I'll let you go for the night. We'll talk. And I know we had some technical difficulties with the recording software earlier. I'm sorry about that. Now, you recorded this too?
I've recorded it.
Okay, so so good. Okay, good. So just in case, I'm going to check, make sure it was working, because I did the update. And sometimes when you do update, you have to tweak and you get, you know, run into some problems. So I'll listen to the interview again.
Yeah, if you had any problem at all, it's so easy for me to send you this recording. So just let me know.
Excellent. Thanks a lot. Thanks for your patience tonight.
All right, man. Enjoy it.
Take it easy. Enjoy your rest of your weekend. Good night.
Okay, bye. Thanks. Bye-bye.